And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is Christmas Eve, December 24th. 358th day of the year. Leap year is 359th. Only 7 days until this year ends. This date in history. In 502, Chinese Emperor Zhao Yan names Chiao Tong his heir designate. 640, Pope John IV is elected several months after his predecessor's death. 759, the Tang Dynasty. A poet Du Fu departs for Chengdu, where he's hosted by fellow poet Pai Di. Say that real fast. 820, Emperor Leo V is assassinated in the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople, succeeded by Michael II. 1144, the capital of the Crusader County of Edessa falls to Imad al-Din Zengi, Attaburg of Mosul and Aleppo. There were a lot of Crusader enclaves set up during the First Crusade because it was quite successful. And one by one, they all fell. 1294, Pope Boniface VIII is elected, replacing St. Celestine V, who had resigned. 1500, a joint Venetian-Spanish fleet captures the castle of St. George on the island of Cephalonia. 1737, the Marathas defeat the combined forces of the Mughal Empire, Rajputs of Jaipur, Nazim of Hyderabad, Nawab of Adwal, and Nawab of Bengal in the Battle of Bhopal. Now, all these names may not mean much, but the Maratha Empire, or the Confederacy, was the power that dominated a large part of the Indian subcontinent in the 18th century, that's 1700s. The empire formally existed from 1674 with the coronation of Shivaji as the Chhatrapati, and ended in 1818 with the defeat of Peshwa Bahario II at the hands of the British East India Company. They're given a lot of credit for ending the Mughal rule over most of the Indian subcontinent. India is an area that's still quite a mystery. There are ancient civilizations that predate almost anything you can find. But then there's ancient civilizations on North America that have been ignored. 1777. Kiritimati, also called Christmas Island, is discovered by James Cook. 1800, the plot of the Rue Saint-Nicaise fails to kill Napoleon Bonaparte. They tried, but it took one of his people close to him to poison him. 1814, representatives of the United Kingdom and United States signed the Treaty of Ghent, ending the War of 1812. 1818, the first performance of Silent Night takes place in the Church of St. Nicholas in Oberndorf, Austria. 1826, the eggnog riot at the United States Military Academy begins that night, wrapping up the following morning. Began on Christmas Eve, wrapped up on Christmas Day. 1846, British acquired La Bande from the Sultanate of Brunei for Great Britain. 1851, the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. is burned. Or it burns. I don't think they ever found out how that fire started. 1865, Jonathan Schenck and Barry Ownby formed the Ku Klux Klan. Actually, the main impetus was Nathan Bedford Forrest, a former Confederate general. 1868, the Greek Presidential Guard is established as royal escort by King George I. 1871, the opera Aida premieres in Cairo, Egypt. 1906, Reginald Fessenden transmits the first radio broadcast. It was a poetry reading, a violin solo, and a speech. 1913, the Italian Hall disaster in Calumet, Michigan results in the deaths of 73 Christmas party participants. 59 of those 73 were children. When someone falsely yells, "Fire!" 1914, World War I, the Christmas truce begins. At one point during the Christmas holidays that year, the two armies were in their trenches opposing each other when somebody started singing Silent Night. And before you knew it, both armies were singing. It was quite interesting. It began a series of widespread unofficial ceasefires along the Western Front. Now, this truce occurred only 5 months into the war. Hostilities had lulled as leadership on both sides reconsidered what they were doing following the stalemate of the race to the sea and the indecisive result of the First Battle of Ypres. In the week leading up to December 25th, French, German, and British soldiers crossed trenches to exchange seasonal greetings and talk. In fact, in some areas, men from both sides went into the no man's land on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day to mingle and exchange food and souvenirs. There were joint burial ceremonies, prisoner swaps, and several of the meetings ended with carol singing. Men also played games of football with one another, creating one of the most memorable images of the truce. Of course, in other areas, hostilities continued. And in others, the sides agreed on little more than arrangements to recover bodies. Now, the following year, a few units arranged ceasefires, but the truces weren't nearly as widespread as they were in 1914. And that was, in part, due to strongly worded orders from the high commands on both sides that prohibited those truces. And by 1916, nobody wanted the truces. The war became increasingly bitter as a result of the heavy losses both sides incurred. Alrighty, 1920, Gabriele D'Annunzio surrendered the Italian regency of Carnaro in the city of Fiume to Italian armed forces. 1924, Albania becomes a republic, and Peter Falk will never be the same. 1929, assassination attempt on Argentine President Hipólito Yrigoyen. 1929, a four-alarm fire breaks out in the west wing of the White House in Washington, D.C. 1939, World War II. Pope Pius XII made a Christmas appeal, Christmas Eve appeal for peace. Didn't amount to much. 1941, World War II. Kuching is conquered by Japanese forces. Also, 1941, World War II. Benghazi is conquered by the British Eighth Army. 1942, World War II, French monarchist Fernand Bonnier de la Chapelle assassinates Vichy French Admiral Francois Darlan in Algiers in Algeria. 1943, World War II, Dwight Eisenhower is named Supreme Allied Commander for the invasion of Normandy. 1945, five of nine children become missing after their home in Fayetteville, West Virginia is burned down. I don't know they ever determined what happened to them. 1951, Libya becomes independent. Idris I is proclaimed king of Libya. 1952, the first flight of Britain's Hadley Page Victor strategic bomber. 1953, Tangiwa disaster. In New Zealand's North Island at Tangiwa, railroad bridge is damaged by a lahar and collapses beneath a passenger train. 151 people died. 1964, Vietnam War. Viet Cong operatives bombed the Brinks Hotel in Saigon, South Vietnam, in order to demonstrate they can strike an American installation in the heavily guarded capital. 1964, Flying Tiger Line Flight 282 crashes after takeoff from San Francisco International Airport. Three people are killed in that crash. 1966, a Canadair CL-44, chartered by the U.S. military, crashes into a small village in South Vietnam. 129 people die. 1968, Apollo program. The crew of Apollo 8 enters into orbit around the moon. They become the first humans known to do so. They perform 10 lunar orbits and broadcast live TV pictures. 1969, Nigerian troops capture Umuahia, the Biafran capital. 1971, Lanza Flight 508 is struck by lightning and crashes in the Puerto Inca district in the department of Huanuco in Peru. 91 people die. 1973, District of Columbia Home Rule Act is passed. It allows the residents of Washington, D.C. to elect their own local government. 1974, Cyclone Tracy devastates Darwin, Australia. 1980, witnesses report that the first of several sightings of unexplained lights near RAF Woodbridge and Rendlesham Forest in Suffolk. This incident has been called Britain's Roswell. It's never been satisfactorily explained. 1994, Air France Flight 8969 is hijacked on the ground at Houari Bourmedien Airport in Algiers. Over the course of 3 days, three passengers are killed, as well as all four terrorists. 1997, the Sidi El Anthre massacre in Algeria kills between 50 and 100 people. 1999, Indian Airlines flight 814 is hijacked in Indian airspace between Kathmandu, Nepal, and Delhi, India. Aircraft eventually landed in Kandahar in Afghanistan. Incident ended December 31st with the release of 190 survivors. One passenger was killed. 2003, the Spanish police thwarted an attempt by ETA to detonate a 50 kilogram of explosives at 3:55 in the afternoon inside Madrid's busy Chamartín station. Now, for those that are not familiar, because I did have an email about it, ETA is the Euskadi Ta Askasuna, Basque Homeland and Liberty, or Basque Country and Freedom. It was an armed leftist Basque nationalist and separatist organization in the Basque Country of northern Spain and southwestern France. The group was founded in 1959, later evolved from a group promoting traditional Basque culture to a paramilitary group engaged in a violent campaign of bombing and assassinations and kidnappings. It was the main group within the Basque National Liberation Movement, and it was classified as a terrorist group by Spain, France, the UK, the US, Canada, and the European Union. Well, they declared ceasefires in 1989, 96, 98, and 2006. And on September 5th, 2010, they declared a new ceasefire that remained in force. And on October 20th, 2011, it announced a definitive cessation of its armed activity. In April 7, 2017, the group announced it had given up all its weapons and explosives. So, what was once a very deadly organization apparently closed up shop and left. 2005, Chad-Sudan relations. Chad declares a state of war against Sudan following a September 18th attack on Andre, which left about 100 people dead. 2008, the Lord's Resistance Army, a Ugandan rebel group, begins a series of attacks against civilians in the Democratic Republic of Congo. They massacred over 400 people. 2018, helicopter crash kills Martha Erica Alonso, first female governor of Puebla, Mexico, and her husband, Rafael Moreno Valle Rosas, former governor. We've got a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian feast days, Adela and Ermina, Paola, Elisabetta, Cerioli, Christmas Eve observances. Well, in Iceland, they have a celebration on the day when the 13th and the last Yule lad arrives to town. The Yule lads are the sons of Gryla and Leopoldi, a group of 13 mischievous pranksters who steal from or otherwise harass the population and all have descriptive names that generally convey their favorite way of causing mischief. They arrive one by one over the final 13 nights leading up to Christmas, and they leave small gifts and shoes that children place on the windowsill. But if the child has been bad, then they put a potato in the shoe instead. Now, if you're hungry, that might not be so bad. In modern times, the Yule lads have also been depicted in a more benevolent role, comparable to Santa Claus and other related figures. They're generally portrayed wearing late medieval Icelandic clothing. Sometimes, though, they show up in costumes traditionally worn by Santa Claus. The names of these interesting individuals are rather difficult to pronounce for non-Icelandics. So let us go back to our celebrations. You know, this being Christmas Eve, there are a lot of celebrations. There's the Feast of the Seven Fishes in Italian-American communities. Juleaften in Denmark. Juleaften in Norway. Juleaften in Sweden. Nidelnacht, certain Orthodox Jewish denominations. Nochebuena in Spain and Spanish-speaking countries. The Decoration of Christmas Peace. Takes place in the old great square of Turku, Finland's official Christmas city. There's Wiglia in Poland. Kwavesuvik, the Inuit New Year in Alaska, Canada, Greenland, Russia. In Libya, it's Independence Day. And in Russia, it's also the Day of Military Honor for the Siege of Ishmael. Let's see if there's anything else worth discussing. In 563, the Byzantine church Hagia Sophia, which is located in Constantinople, and it's quite a massive building, is dedicated for the second time after being destroyed by an earthquake. In 1476, 400 Burgundian soldiers freeze to death during the Siege of Nancy. In 1715, Swedish troops move in and occupy Norway. In 1799, Jacobin plot against Napoleon is uncovered. In 1832, the first U.S. Negro hospital founded by whites is chartered in Savannah, Georgia. 1832, HMS Beagle anchors in Wigwam Bay at Cape Receiver. In that fire in 1851 in the U.S. Congress, 35,000 volumes are destroyed. In 1877, Thomas Edison files patents for the phonograph. he apparently filed a series of patents. 1893, on this date, Henry Ford completes his first useful petrol gasoline-fueled engine. 1895, George Vanderbilt, if you don't know about the Vanderbilts, very wealthy family, opened Biltmore Estate, the largest privately owned house in America. It was 178,926 square feet, located in Asheville, North Carolina. And if you were chasing somebody through that house, you could run for 2 days before you found them. Well, we've come to the end of our history session. We're going to talk some about more serial killers. In South Africa, Moses Sithole. He's hands down the worst serial murderer in South African history. Astonishingly, when tried, he was found guilty of 38 murders between January and October 1995. That was 38 murders in just 10 months, or about 4 a month. And by anybody's reckoning, that's bloodlust. Now, he was a good-looking, charming, and very bold young man. He'd approach women in broad daylight and somehow lure them into surrounding isolated fields where he'd attack. He stripped them, beat them, raped them, and then strangled them with his own clothing. Sometimes he'd tie them up, and sometimes he would cover their faces with an article of clothing, symbolically, if not actually, preventing them from seeing him. Now, the killings happened so fast and so vicious that the entire country was in a state of alarm, including President Nelson Mandela, who actually canceled an important political trip to plead for the public's help in tracking the killer down. So desperate were South African authorities to solve the crimes, which they call the ABC murders, that they started in Atteridgeville, moved to Boksburg, then continued to Cleveland. That they brought in two renowned profilers to work the case. The premier South African profiler, Mickey Pistorius, and the famed FBI agent, Robert Ressler. Now, their collaboration didn't result in the capture of the killer, but Ressler provided one helpful insight. He was the first to connect the murders in the three towns to one killer. Until then, each police force was pretty much operating on its own. In October 1995, having killed his 38, the killer contacted Cape Town Star newspaper and claimed to be the ABC murderer. During the call, which of course the Star recorded, he made a series of complaints that contained specific information. He said he'd been convicted of a rape in 78 that he said he didn't do, but as a result, he spent 14 years in prison. He said he had to endure the death of his parents and sister while he was behind bars. He said his experience built up a terrible need for revenge in him, and he took it out on women. He said, "I force a woman to go where I want. When I get there, I tell them, 'Do you know what? I was hurt, so I'm doing it now.' And he said, 'Then I kill them.'" Star reporter talking to him, asking him just how many women he had killed, and he had a stunning answer. 76. That was twice as many victims as the police thought he had killed. And to prove he was the killer, he finished the call with directions to the body of one of his victims. Thankfully, though, the caller, in his desire to talk, provided more than enough personal information for police to identify him as Moses Sithole. Police soon focused on him and ultimately arrested him. When the police located him, he went after him with a hatchet, but he was shot and, to use their expression, neutralized. And in the hospital, it was learned he was HIV positive. He couldn't get a break, no matter what he did. Went on trial in February 1997, charged with 38 murders, 40 rapes, and six counts of robbery. December 5th, 1997, he's found guilty and sentenced to 2,410 years, eligible for parole after 1,000 years. Now, it was thought he'd die from within 7 or 8 years of his trial with HIV-related complications, but as of right now, he's still alive and kicking. Behind bars, to be sure, but he's kicking. Well, we've got quite a number of other. Let's talk about Gary Ridgway. He was on TV the other night, the Green River Killer. Now, he made a confession when he pled guilty to murdering 48 women in the notorious Green River killings. And the prosecutor read it in court. He said, I killed the 48 women listed in the state's second amended information. And in most cases, when I killed these women, I didn't know their names. Most of the time, I killed them the first time I met them, and I don't have a good memory for faces. I've reviewed information and discovery about each of the murders of my attorneys. I'm positive I killed each one of the women charged in that second information. Killed most of them in my house near Military Road, and I killed a lot of them in my truck not far from where I picked them up. Killed some of them outside. I remember leaving each woman's body in the place where she was found. I've discussed with my attorneys the common scheme or plan, aggravating circumstances charged in all these murders. And I agree that each of the murders I committed was part of a common scheme or plan. Well, it's interesting to note that there have been quite a number of serial killers who are still continuing to kill. No idea who they are. Among those are the Zodiac. One of his codes was just broken the other day. He sent letters to the police with codes. There we go. We're back. Had a little bit of microphone trouble. Don't know why it wanted to act up. It was doing just fine. From serial killers, we're going to talk about some less than genius level criminals. The sometimes being a judge is no guarantee the person's got good judgment. I know one right here in this town. Actually, I'm more than one. Judge in this case is Sharon Killer Keller, presiding judge on the Texas Criminal Courts of Appeal. In 2007, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case of on the constitutionality of lethal injection to execute condemned prisoners. Michael Richard was to be executed in Texas that very night. Richard's lawyers wanted to request a stay of execution based on a Supreme Court's action, but they had computer problems. And short before 5 p.m., they called the Court of Appeal and asked if it could remain open a few minutes past closing time so they can file their papers. Judge Keller responded, telling me close at 5. Well, the lawyers missed the deadline, and Richard was executed a few hours later. I'm sure the attorneys were very unhappy about that. Well, Keller was charged with 5 counts of misconduct relating to that particular case. Her other claim to fame, authoring a 1997 opinion that denied a new trial to a man serving 99 years for aggravated rape after DNA testing excluded him as a suspect in the crime. Keller told an interviewer, "We can't give new trials to everybody who establishes after conviction they might be innocent." What if she was on the other side? Well, in 2010, she was fined $100,000 for failing to list more than $2.8 million in assets on financial disclosure forms. They didn't do anything to her for killing somebody or refusing to make a just decision in regard to the man whose DNA testing showed he couldn't have been the killer. But if she didn't declare her money, they were right on top of her. Well, let's talk about what was referred to as the milkshake murder. In the early 1960s, Rene Castellani was working for radio station CKNW in Vancouver, Canada. He was known for his publicity stunts. To help the BOMAC car dealership sell more automobiles, he stayed perched on top of the 10-story BOMAC sign for 8 days. Said he wouldn't leave till every single car was sold. He also once posed as an Indian prince and drove around town in a limo with bodyguards and dancing girls. He was a devoted husband. Bought his wife Esther a daily treat of a vanilla milkshake. 1965, Esther's health began to fail with each shake she drank. Started to get stomach and lower back pains that kept her out of work. About this same time, she found a love letter in Renee's pocket and confronted him about it. But her health was the biggest concern. Began to have bouts of nausea, diarrhea, and intense vomiting. Her fingers and toes went numb. She couldn't walk or use her hands. For 2 months, she was hospitalized as doctors puzzled over her condition, and they could not figure out what it was. Well, in August of 1965, she died at the age of 40, left behind her husband and her 12-year-old daughter. Now, Renee was carrying on an affair with a strawberry blonde receptionist at the radio station, and he planned on marrying her. The only roadblock, of course, was the fact he was already married, so to take care of that, he needed Esther out of the way. So instead of asking her for a divorce, he decided to murder her. Autopsy revealed that Esther had 1,500 times the normal level of arsenic in her body. Medical examiners determined she had been ingesting it for more than 6 months, including the period of time she was in the hospital. Well, after a lot of research to determine where she got it, it was finally discovered it was in those daily milkshake deliveries from her husband. Well, police got a search warrant, searched the Castellani home, and found Triox weed killer beneath the kitchen sink. And it was missing the exact amount of poison that was estimated to have been in Esther's body. And from her hair, they got more evidence. Scientists could chart the amount of arsenic Esther consumed each day from a strand of her long black hair. Curiously, the hair revealed that during the 8 days that Renee was on top of the BOMAC sign, when the milkshake deliveries were not forthcoming, there was no sign of poison in her system. About 3 months after the murder, Renee applied for a license to marry the receptionist. Unfortunately, 2 days later, the police arrested him, and he got convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison. And he was surprised that his main squeeze didn't want to continue the relationship since he was going to prison. Well, a lot of cases are decided on DNA. And DNA has come a long way since the late 80s and early 90s. And there are two significant events that helped push DNA testing along. 1987, the West Virginia Supreme Court ruled that DNA evidence could be used in a trial. It was a rape case, giving the use of DNA evidence in the courtroom its first major legal precedent. And then in 1989, Gary Dotson of Chicago became the first person in history to have a conviction overturned through the use of DNA testing. It was a heart-rending case. Dotson had been convicted in 1979 of the violent rape of a 16-year-old girl and sentenced to 25 to 50 years in prison. 6 years into his sentence, the victim admitted she'd made the whole thing up. She lied. And nobody would take his word for it. Earlier that day, she'd had sex with her boyfriend for the first time, was afraid she'd become pregnant. But even with her recanting her testimony, it took another 4 years and DNA evidence proving that semen taken from the girl's underwear was her boyfriend's and not Dotson's. Well, the courts, once they got somebody locked up, they don't want to change because that makes the DA look bad. We can't have that. Between setting a legal precedent and demonstrating the immense potential DNA testing had within the criminal justice system, it was these two cases that set the course for the rapid development of forensic science. The problem is district attorneys don't want to admit they prosecuted the wrong person. So, let's talk about stars behind bars. Charles S. Dutton is the first one. He had a recurring role on the TV show House as the father of Dr. Foreman. In 1967, a 16-year-old Dutton killed a man in a knife fight and served time for manslaughter. Caught with a deadly weapon while on parole, he went back to prison. He attacked a guard, and more time was added to his sentence. Well, while in solitary confinement refusing a work assignment, he read a book of plays from the prison library. He credits Days of Absence by Douglas Turner Ward with inspiring him to turn his life around. Got paroled in 1976. Acted in the local theater, got a college degree, and won admission to the Yale Drama School. And this led to a career on Broadway and in film and on TV. He said, I consider myself a living testament to the power of the arts, he said. And, of course, the next star we're going to talk about, everybody's heard of him, Tim Allen. Stand-up comedian, film actor, and star of Home Improvement and Last Man Standing. 1978, he was arrested for drug trafficking after he tried to sell 1.4 pounds of cocaine to an undercover cop. I don't know why police are out there buying cocaine. Doesn't make a lot of sense. That was enough to get him sent away for life, but he copped a plea and testified against other drug dealers. So he got a little bit more than 2 years in federal prison. While awaiting sentencing, he made his first appearance as a stand-up comedian at the Comedy Castle in Detroit. He said the judge suggested I get my act together, and I took him seriously. And the rest is history. Well, as I can testify these days, it seems that people sue each other over practically anything. Let's talk about some bizarre legal battles. The plaintiff was Toshi Van Blitter, the defendant, Harris Casino. After losing $350,000 playing blackjack, Van Blitter decided to sue the Las Vegas casino. She filed to have her debts canceled, claiming that Harris was negligent. They should have told her that she was an incompetent blackjack player. Well, unfortunately, that gamble didn't pay off because a federal judge dismissed her claim. Then we have Timothy Ray Anderson, an armed robber. And he sued John Thompson, a security guard at a McDonald's restaurant. Yes, McDonald's needs security guards. Well, Anderson was robbing at McDonald's at gunpoint. Hobson ordered him to drop the weapon. Anderson spun around, aimed his gun at Hobson, and Hobson shot him. Hit him in the stomach. Anderson was subsequently convicted of armed robbery and sentenced to 15 years. Anderson then sued Hobson, the firm Hobson worked for, and the owner of the McDonald's, claiming excessive force was used against him. His argument was the mere fact that you're holding up a McDonald's with a gun doesn't mean you give up your right to be protected from somebody who wants to shoot you. Now, he had to go some to find a dumbass attorney that would file that for him. You know, the case was thrown out of court. But I've seen a lot of dumbass attorneys in this town, let me tell you. Well, then there are crooks that are so stupid that they might as well handcuff themselves and close their own cell door. One night in July of 2009, 18-year-old Daniel Barr of Strasburg, Pennsylvania, and a bunch of his friends driving around decided it would be fun to throw eggs at a police car. So they found a parked cruiser and threw a dozen eggs at it, and they might have gotten away with it. But they chose a police car that was occupied by a police officer. He was sitting there very still, and they didn't notice there was anybody in the car when they threw the eggs. January 2008, a 53-year-old man and his 20-year-old accomplice set out to rob the Vernon British Columbia Bank of CIBC British Columbia branch of CIBC Bank. The older man went into the bank to commit the actual robbery while the younger man stayed in the getaway car listening to the radio. When the older man came back, the car wouldn't start. He had run the battery down listening to the radio. So they got out of the car and ran down the street, but were caught a few minutes later. And why were they caught so quickly? It seems that CIBC Bank is located next door to the police station. And somebody told them those two guys running had donuts, and by God, they ran them down. 33-year-old Sean Lester stormed into a Charleston, West Virginia convenience store, filled up a cup at the soda fountain, and demanded all the money in the register, claiming he had a gun. Well,
Before the clerk could get the money out to give to him, Lester got cold feet and didn't want to go through with the robbery. So he turned to walk out of the store, carrying that drink he had filled up at the soda fountain. Well, the clerk stopped him, told him he had to pay for it, so he did. Used his debit card. Even though he signed the receipt, John Doe, and didn't actually steal any money, police actually traced the debit card. Wasn't that hard, and arrested Lester at his home. If you're going to do something, don't leave your name behind. If you look at your debit card, your name is on it. Well, one day in June of 2009, an employee at Ziggy's, a hardware store in Spokane, Washington, found a plastic bag filled with small crystallized rocks on the floor near the checkout. Thinking it was crystal meth, the employee called the police, but before they arrived, 34-year-old Christopher Wilson walked in and asked if anybody had found a bag of crystal meth he thought he might have lost in the store. And the employee lied and told him they hadn't seen any, so Wilson left his name and phone number just in case the drugs turned up. And then he went on home. Police showed up a few minutes later and arrested him. You can't trust anybody anymore. Well, in 2009, a Massachusetts man showed up at a police station and asked to have a pair of handcuffs removed. Earlier that day, the man's sister put the cuffs on him as a joke, and then she proceeded to lose the key. Well, on a whim, the police decided to run the man's name through their computer and discovered that he had several outstanding warrants. So they took off the handcuffs he was wearing and gave him a new set. I hope his sister was happy. Well, in 1978, two wealthy Arab sheikhs started inviting U.S. government officials to meetings. Purpose of the meetings? They had a ton of money and they wanted help making investments in the United States. Well, several government officials happily took the sheikhs' money and invested it in their own pockets in exchange for helping secure purchases of casinos, mining companies, and other American businesses. And no, we're not talking about the son of a current American official. Well, the sheikhs weren't sheikhs. They were undercover FBI agents. It's all part of the agency's Abscams operation. That name came from Abdul, the name of the fictitious company the sheikhs owned in Scam. And the government officials? 8 members of Congress. 5 members of the House of Representatives went to federal prison, as should all of them. As did Senator Harrison Williams of New Jersey, was videotaped promising the sheikhs he'd secure contracts to open a titanium mine in exchange for shares in the company. He remains one of only 2 U.S. senators in history who went to prison for crimes committed in office. And you couldn't get a book big enough to hold the names of all the representatives who've gone to prison. Well, a 2008 report by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police said the gang members involved in international drug smuggling had infiltrated airports in major cities around the country, and most were working as baggage handlers. Well, Canada's Criminal Intelligence Service estimates that more than 11,000 Canadians are members of street gangs. More than 130 gangs are based in Vancouver alone, vying for drug business estimated to be worth more than $6 billion a year. Well, in the late 1990s, Toronto police arrested 4 members of the Spadina Girls, a short-lived all-female gang led by a 16-year-old girl. The gang charged other students for protection. Arrest came after gang members brutally assaulted a fellow student at a billiards hall. Much more dangerous all-female gang has formed in recent years is called the Indian Posse Girls, an offshoot of the Indian Posse. They're believed to be in control of the sex trade in Winnipeg and Edmonton. I don't know how big that trade is. It gets awful cold there. Well, in 1913, thousands of people with the last name Drake got letters from the Sir Francis Drake Association. That was an organization founded for the purpose of settling the estate of the legendary British buccaneer who died 300 years ago. Any Drake descendant who wanted to share the estate was welcome. All they had to do was contribute toward the $2,500 a week legal expenses needed to pursue the case. And the fight was underway, and any Drake descendant who hesitated risked being cut out entirely and not getting a dime. Well, the scam was the work of an Iowa con man named Oscar Merrill Hartzell. He got the idea for his version after his mother was conned out of several thousand dollars in another Drake estate scam. When he tracked down the crooks who swindled her and realized how much money they were making, he decided rather than call the police, he'd keep quiet and launch his own version of the scam. Using the money he'd recovered for his mother, he promptly sent out letters to more than 20,000 Drakes. Well, by the time the feds caught up with him, more than 20 years later, he had swindled an estimated 70,000 people out of more than $2 million. Rather than admit they'd been duped, many of the victims donated an additional $350,000 toward his legal defense. Well, he was convicted of mail fraud and sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. A few years later, he was transferred to a mental institution where he died in 1943. That's a version of the Nigerian Prince scam. I get 4 or 5 emails a day from every agency you can imagine that my money, it's been as little as $2 million to as much as $20 million, has been put on an ATM card. And if I'll just send the processing fee, they'll send me that card and I can go to any ATM and pull out my money. Then they I got an email that the individual's at the airport. I needed to come get him, put him up in a hotel room. He had to get on an airplane to come give me my card, and I had to feed him and house him. I've had, I guess I've probably had 200 emails of this type. Everybody from Nigerian princes to politicians to rock stars to GIs who found millions hidden in the desert and want me to help them smuggle them out of the country. They just need a little help on the fees, don't you know? Well, from Nigerian princes, let's talk about Texas cheerleading. In Texas, that's serious business. There was an individual known as the Texas Cheerleader Mom. Her name was Wanda Holloway. In 1991, she lived in Houston, worked as a secretary, and played the piano at her church. Oh, she was a wonderful woman. All the people liked her. Tried to hire a hitman to kill the mother of a rival cheerleader at her daughter's middle school. You see, she really, really wanted her daughter, Shanna Harper, to be a cheerleader. And Shanna failed to make the cheerleading squad because of improper campaigning. It's frowned upon to offer sex in return for votes, don't you know? Though apparently a lot of that went on in this last election. Her mother had given away pencils, rulers with Shanna's name on them to promote her, apparently. That's a big no-no, don't you know? And that disqualified Shanna. Well, the next year, she wanted to give her daughter an extra edge. Now, that wasn't helping her with her routine. Wanda decided to murder their neighbor, Werner Heath, whose daughter Amber was also trying to make the cheerleader squad. And Wanda thought that Amber would be so distraught at the death of her mother, she wouldn't be able to cheer, and open the door for her own little Shanna to get on the team. So did Werner Heath get bumped off? No. See, one of the big problems in this country is you can't find an honest hitman. Everyone you get turns out to be an undercover police officer. And that's just, as one person said who got arrested, that's just entrapment. Well, she got arrested because Wanda Holloway chose her co-conspirator so poorly, her whole plan fell apart. The twice-married Holloway approached her former brother-in-law, Terry Harper, about finding somebody to do the deed. And Harper immediately told the authorities about Holloway's plans. Then he wore a wire when he went to talk to her. Now, Holloway toyed with the idea of killing both Werner and Amber Heath, but she didn't like the $7,500 asking price that Harper quoted. Chose instead the more economical route of bumping off only the mother. That was a real bargain at just $2,500. Holloway said, and this is a direct quote from the tape, "Maybe I should go with her mother. The kids, she can just be screwed with the murder, mess with her mind." Well, later, Holloway met with the undercover hitman, handed over a pair of diamond earrings in payment. And that's solicitation for capital murder. So she went on trial in 1991, was convicted and sentenced to 15 years in prison. But a mistrial was declared when it was discovered that one of the jurors was improperly impaneled. Turns out he was on probation for cocaine possession. And unfortunately, I don't know why, that was enough to get him out of the jury pool in Texas. 1996, she pleaded no contest to solicitation to capital murder and got sentenced to 10 years in prison. But after just 6 months, she was released on probation. So did Shanna make the cheerleading team? Unfortunately not. But Amber Heath was on the cheerleading squad throughout high school. Well, let's talk about Fight Club. In the 1999 movie Fight Club, Tyler Durden, played by Brad Pitt, runs an underground club where men have bloody fist fights with each other. You don't need to join the club to do that. Just go down to downtown El Paso some Saturday night. They also belong to Project Mayhem, a terrorist cell that blows up symbols of corporate America, including in one scene a Starbucks coffee shop. Well, the film has garnered a huge cult following. One of the biggest fans was 17-year-old Kyle Shaw, who maintained he actually wanted to be Tyler Durden. So in 2009, he started his own fight club in New York City. But fighting his fellow teenagers wasn't enough. So following the model of Project Mayhem, Shaw built a crude homemade bomb and set it off in front of a Starbucks in the middle of the night, completely destroying an outdoor bench. Somebody else immediately started a protect our bench movement. Ignoring the first rule of Fight Club, which is you don't talk about Fight Club, Shaw bragged about it to his friends. And one of those loud mouths went to the police. Oh, incidentally, the jail that Shaw got sent to had its own version of Fight Club. It's called The Program. While he was on a payphone, a much larger inmate walked up, hit him in the face, gave him a black eye for his appearance in court the next day. You just can't trust some folks. Well, let's talk about what's referred to as court transcripts. The following quotes actually came from court transcripts. The judge, I know you, don't I? Defendant, yes. Judge, all right, how do I know you? Defendant, judge, do I have to tell you? Judge, of course you might be obstructing justice not to tell me. Defendant, okay, I was your bookie. Da-da-da-dum. Judge, please identify yourself for the record. Defendant, Colonel Ebenezer Jackson. Judge, what does the colonel stand for? Defendant, well, it's kind of like the honorable in front of your name. Not a damn thing. Judge, you're charged with habitual drunkenness. Have you anything to say in your defense? Defendant, habitual thirstiness. Plaintiff's lawyer, what doctor treated you for the injuries you sustained while at work? Plaintiff, Dr. J. Plaintiff's lawyer, what kind of physician is Dr. J? Plaintiff, well, I'm not sure, but I remember you said he was a good plaintiff's doctor. Defendant, if I call you a son of a bitch, what would you do? Judge, and hold you in contempt and assess an additional 5 days in jail. Defendant, what if I thought you were a son of a bitch? Judge, I can't do a thing about that. There's no law against thinking. Defendant, in that case, I think you're a son of a bitch. Doesn't say what happened to him. But the judge just said, I can't charge you for thinking. 2012, Michelle Chapman reported to police her family members have been trolling her online, relentlessly bombarding her social media with vile and menacing comments. When police investigated, they discovered that Michelle had set up catfish accounts and had posted the insults on her real account herself. She was the first person in Britain to be arrested for trolling herself. You know, if they gave her a motor, she'd actually have a trolling motor. Well, let me ask you a question. Who wants to sue a billionaire? Apparently everybody. Plaintiff, Hollywood producer Steve Bing. Defendant, movie studio mogul Kurt Kerkorian. Lawsuit, Kerkorian's ex-wife, Lisa Bonder, sued for $320,000 a month and child support for their 4-year-old daughter. You know, you got to buy a lot of stuff when you're four. Billionaire Kerkorian claimed he couldn't possibly be the father. He's sterile. He also said he had proof that the real father was Bonder's ex-boyfriend, multimillionaire Bing. His private detectives had collected DNA evidence. They went through Bing's garbage and found some useful dental floss. Probability that Bing's the father, 99.993%. Bing sued for invasion of privacy, asking a staggering $1 billion in damages. Verdict. They settled quietly out of court, and the suit was dropped. One of the best quotes out of O.J. Simpson, I always thought I'd been pretty good with people. I basically spent a conflict-free life, you know. That's why he was tried for murder, and he's in prison right now, or was in prison for quite some time. Well, everybody talks about GPS. Well, there are those that say that stands for Great Policing Service. You can't prove it by me in this town. When you're leading a life of crime, GPS isn't quite as nifty as it is for the rest of us. 2009, 22-year-old Jeremiah Gillum stole an Xbox from a home in an affluent section of Westchester County, New York, just north of New York City. Took it to his grandmother's apartment in the Bronx and decided to play a game. But to do so, he had to log on to the victim's Xbox Live account. Well, when he did that, it made it easy for the police to track down the IP address that led him straight to Grandma's. When they showed up to question Gilliam, they found 50 stolen gadgets. And in one swoop, solved dozens of unsolved burglaries in Westchester County. Police sirens blared behind William Bowen as he drove a car full of stolen contraband through Steens, Mississippi. Didn't know how the police tracked him down, but he figured one of the stolen items had a GPS device, so he started flinging stuff out of the car. Purses, wallets, guns. Well, he couldn't get away from the police, though. They were keeping a safe distance behind him. If he'd only thrown away the stolen cell phone, he might have gotten away, but that's the one thing he kept. That's one of the few cases where somebody stole a cell phone with GPS and all his movements led us right to him. Some days you just can't win. Well, forensic science and by extension the criminal justice system's come a long way with the assistance of technology. 1901, human blood groups were identified and described by Austrian Dr. Karl Landsteiner, who subsequently codified his discoveries into blood types that we know today. Now, this discovery was useful in the field of forensics as well as in medicine in general, and it got him a Nobel Prize in 1930. Took folks 29 years to figure out how to say his name. 1910, Rosella Rousseau confesses to the murder of Germaine Bichon. Why? Because her hairs matched the hairs at the crime scene. This technique was pioneered by Victor Balthazard, professor of forensic medicine at the Sorbonne. That same year, another French professor of forensic medicine, Edmond Locard, helped create the first police crime lab. The first U.S. crime lab was founded in 1925 by Los Angeles Police Chief August Vollmer. They thought it was just a fad that would go away. Well, we've come to the end of another show. Tomorrow is Christmas, and I'll be doing a Christmas show. So until tomorrow at this time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening, and Merry Christmas to all of you.